Greetings and welcome to the final installation in our series of podcasts on the Book of Ruth, Megillat Ruth. We are in the middle of Chapter 4, the final chapter of Megillat Ruth, Perek Daled. And before beginning, just a little bit of a background as to the first half of the fourth chapter. The first half takes place entirely at one scene at the courthouse, which is at the gates of the city of Beit Lechem, where Boaz has offered the opportunity to redeem Elimelech's field to the first relative in line, the Goel, whose name here is Ploni Almoni. In this podcast, we'll discuss why his name is erased. And the Redeemer agrees to redeem Elimelech's field. Boaz then throws Ruth into the mix. In the last podcast, we spoke at length about how and why he did that. The Goel refused, and Boaz then, through the symbolic act of the removal of a shoe, then acquires the rights, and then goes ahead and acquires Naomi's field and Ruth as wife. All of the people around answer to his declaration in verse 9 and 10, that he has done all of these things and has made them witnesses, and they all answer, yes, they are witnesses, and that's where we pick up in the middle of Perek Yud, in Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. Now, one point to note that I mentioned at the very beginning of the series. All of Megillat Ruth, which is separated into four chapters in the Christian division of chapter divisions in the Bible, which is, of course, not inherent in the text, nor does it have any basis in Jewish literary history, and the division works out pretty well for the scenes and for the different components of the story. Nonetheless, when you look at all of Megillat Ruth from a traditional perspective, from a perspective of Textus Receptus, for the Masoretic text, the entire piece is one story, up until verse 17. Verses 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 are a separate parasha mesorah, a separate paragraph in the Masoretic text. And so when we get to verse 17, we will then discuss what the function of the last five verses is, and there's several oddities about that we'll get to. But in the meantime, back in verse 11, and as I promised, I am attaching to this podcast a diagram of several of the words that are key words here and that show up earlier in the text and how they relate to each other. But first, let's get to the text. In the middle of verse 11, after the formal legal declaration, Edim, yes, we are witnesses to your purchase of the field and of your acquisition of Ruth as a wife, Yitain Adonai Taisha Haba El Beitecha Kerachel Uchalea Asher Banu Shtehem Et Beit Yisrael. This is a beautiful, beautiful blessing. God should, first we'll translate it, we'll translate verse 12, and then talk about the implications. This is all one blessing. God should grant that the woman, Habayal Betachu, comes into your house, that's Ruth, should be like Rachel Uleya, like the wives of Yaakov, Asher Banu Shtehem Beit Yisrael, that together the two of them built the house of Israel, built meaning gave birth to. Vasechayel Befrata, you should be successful or be famous or more significantly be wealthy in Ephrata, ukras shem beveit lachem, and you should make a name for yourself, be famous, that's what that phrase means, and we'll see it in a more more distinct way in a couple of psukim, in Beit Lechem. Now this is a poetic feature which likely was an ancient blessing in the area, Haseichael Befrata Krashem Beit Lechem, because Ephrat and Beit Lechem are of course the same place. They are cognomens for Ephrat is a cognomen for Beit Lechem, and therefore the phrase is a fairly common blessing, very likely given at weddings or at births in the area. Now, the next pasuk, which continues, is Vihi Veitcha Kevet Peretz. Who's Peretz? We'll talk about him in a minute. Your house should be like the house of Peretz. Asher Yalda Tamar Li Yehuda. Who Tamar birthed Peretz from Yehuda. Yehuda is the father. Min HaZera Sheiten Adonai Lecha Min HaNarazot. From the seed that God should give you from this girl. Now notice, Ruth is not mentioned by name. Whether that's good or bad is not our issue. Just note that the people do not mention her by name. They say the woman who comes into your house, this girl, that's what they call her. Now, what are the implications of these blessings? The first thing is that the mention of Rachel and Leah is a little bit curious. Why? Because this is Yehuda. These people are all members of the tribe of Judah. And Judah, as you will recall, is a child of Leah. Nonetheless, in their tribal blessing that they give to people who are marrying, they say she should be like Rachel and Leah, and they put Rachel first, which seems to indicate that even the tribe of Judah recognized that Rachel, even though she was the second wife, she was the younger wife, she only bore two children as opposed to Leah who bore seven, nonetheless, she is the major, the significant wife, the significant player in Yaakov's life, and therefore the blessing is Kirachel Uchaleah. Parenthetically, this is the only mention of Leah outside of the book of Bereishit, except for a mention in Divrei Hayamim, again as part of recapping the genealogy of Bereishit. But this is the only mention of the name of Leah. Rachel is mentioned several other places, most famously, of course, in Jeremiah 31, in Kol Brahma Nishma. In any case, the notion is that Rachel and Leah together built the house of Israel. This woman should be as great as Rachel and Leah, who did that, and I say, Chayel Befrata Ukrashem Vitlachem, and you should become famous, and become powerful, etc. And the next part of the blessing is, your house should be like the house of Peretz. Now, why is Peretz mentioned here? Because this entire family of the tribe of Judah traces their lineage back, and we'll see that later on at the end of the book, to Peretz. Who is Peretz? Let's think about this and see why this is so significant. I'd like to suggest at this point something that I mentioned in the Esther series, and I believe that can be borne out here again. All narratives in Jewish history, even post-biblical history, ultimately are anchored in something in Tanakh. Just one example. There was a story about Unklus, who was a Roman who decided to convert, and at some point he was summoned by the Caesar, and he was summoned several times, and each time the soldiers who came saw his great behavior, and they refused to take him. According to one version, they were struck down. According to another version, they were converted. In any case, it didn't work. And this happened several times. If you look at that story, and you find that there are two similar stories in Tanakh. One is at the beginning of the second book of Kings, in the first chapter, when three sets of soldiers come from Ahaziyahu to take Eliyahu Hanavi, who is claiming that the king is going to die because he is worshipping Baal's Vuv. And he sends three sets of soldiers, and the third set finally says, don't kill us, etc. How that has an earlier parallel, which is in the book, first book of Samuel, chapter 19, when David ran away, out the window, when Michal let him out the window, he ran away to the pastures of Ramah, where Shmuel was overseeing a prophetic exercise on the part of the Guild of the Prophets. Saul sent three sets of soldiers. Each set of soldiers that came to take David to kill him, instead were seized by the spirit of prophecy, until finally Saul said, if I'm going to get something done, I got to get it done myself. He went himself, and he also was seized by the spirit of prophecy, giving David time to run away. And so there are models that happen in Midrashic literature that seem to be associated with stories that are in the text. And ultimately, every story in the text of Tanakh finds its anchor in the book of Bereishit in one form or another. We spoke about this in the context of Esther, how the entire story of the rise of Esther in a foreign court has many associations, both associations of theme, associations of word, with the story of Yosef, who is the first Jew in the foreign court. In the same way, the story of Ruth has, as we pointed out along the way in the first two chapters, echoes many ideas, themes, phrases, associations from the beginning of the narrative of Tanakh, including the beginning of the story that there was a famine in the land, in the third chapter, Vayhi b'chatzi halayla, which evokes the exodus of Shmot, Vayelech ish mi beit, at the beginning of the book, which reminds us of Vayelech ish mi beit Levi, many, many associations like that. The entire story of Ruth and Boaz coming together evokes in more than one way the story of Yehuda, Tamar, Erve Onan, Peretz. And I'm using specifically those five names, and I'll explain why right now. In Genesis 38, where that story is there as an independent module, Yehuda, who separates from his family, goes and marries a Canaanite woman. We don't know her name. He has three kids. The first one is named Er, the second one is named Onan, and I discussed their names and the meaning of their names in the first podcast, because Er and Onan are terrible names. Er means childless, Onan means mourning, with a U, mourning, sadness. Nobody would rightfully give their kids names like that. Now, indeed, there are ways to interpret those names as positive also, but it's just as likely that once the story already happened, and remember, we first hear about the story hundreds of years later at Har Sinai, once the story happens, the text perhaps gives them names that reflect the way that their life played out. Er ve'Onan ended up dying. Who is the third child? Shelah. Shelah, which means illusion, is the child that Yehuda promises to Tamar. Tamar had married Er. Er died. Yehuda told his son Onan, perform Yibum, the levirate marriage, on Tamar. He refused to. He died also. And then Yehuda did not want his third son to die, as it were, at Tamar's hands. And therefore he told Tamar, go back home and wait till he grows up. But indeed, he never intended to have her marry her. Thus, he himself was an illusion. Illusion. And therefore, as an illusion, his name being Shelah is perfectly fit. As such, the story of Yehuda has many parallels in our story. First of all, the idea of having two kids who die childless and who evidently are bad guys and having these terrible names, Machlon and Kilion, as we discussed, the simplest reading of that is very bad names. In the meantime, what happens back in Bereshit Lamed Chet is that Tamar, who seeks nothing more than to be the progenitor of Yehuda's seed in one way or another and to keep this family going, uses subterfuge, including sneaking in the dark and dressing up like a prostitute in order that Yehuda will have relations with her so that she can bear him children. It ultimately succeeds, and Yehuda himself realizes his own greatness when he publicly admits that Tamar was Tzadka Mimeni, she's the righteous one. It's a great story in Bereshit Lamed Chet, in chapter 38 of Genesis. And the result of that is that Tamar has twins, and the first kid is about to come out, and the second one pushes away out first, and they say to him, Ma paratz talacha peretz, why are you jumping out so quick? And they called him Peretz. Peretz is the ancestor of the family of Boaz. Boaz, as we'll see in a little bit, is a direct descendant of Peretz. So Peretz is the family name here in Beit Lechem. And therefore, when they bless Boaz, and they bless his house, they say, your house should be like the house of Peretz that Tamar bore to Yehuda from the seed that this girl gives you. And the blessing here is very apt, because it's not just that we are descendants of Peretz, we are indeed Mishpachata Partzi, but not only that, but the story of Ruth sneaking up to Boaz in the middle of the night and him not knowing who she was, everything else seems to be on the one hand an echo of Tamar's, shall we say, encounter with Yehuda, and on the other hand seems to be in a sense a reparation for that, because Boaz does not act on that impulse, and as we talked about in two podcasts ago, Boaz restrains himself until the morning when everything plays out the way it's supposed to, as we're seeing right in front of us right now. So this blessing is very apt, not only for the family, but also for the events. Now that is the beautiful bracha. In the meantime, what happens? Vayikach Boaz et Rut vatilo leisha. So even though the people don't mention Ruth's name, the text has no problem with that. Vayikach Boaz et Ruth, he took Ruth, vatilo leisha, and he married her. Vayavoi leha, he had relations with her. Vayitein Adonai la herayon, God allowed her to become, or gave her the blessing of pregnancy. Vatein leben, she had a son. Now there are two opposite ways to read that phrase, which will then take us back to the first chapter to discuss what happened. Do we understand that God giving her pregnancy means that normally she would not be able to conceive, and God usurped nature or blessed her in a special way, opening up her womb, to use the biblical phrase, to allow her to have a child, which means she was essentially and physiologically a barren woman? Or do we say the opposite, that really she was a fertile woman, and Elimelech's two sons were either physiologically or due to divine intervention, not blessed with children, and that now that Ruth is marrying somebody who is a proper person, she's given children right away? Unclear. We really don't know how to settle that question. Do we count Ruth as one of the barren women in the Bible, of which there are seven explicit barren women, or do we say that that you know, she was a perfectly fertile woman, and now that she married Boaz, she's able to have a child? In any case, this child is certainly a great blessing and a great sign, and a miraculous child in a different way, if not physiologically. Now that the child is born, what happens? Now, if you recall, back in chapter 1 at the end, there was a group of women who were at Beit Lechem when Naomi arrived with Ruth, and they said, Hazot Naomi. They had two words. Their part was two words, Hazot Naomi, to which Naomi responded, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, I'm very bitter, etc., etc., and she complains. That's all they got to say. Now that same quote-unquote Greek chorus responds a different way. Now notice, they don't talk to Ruth, they talk to Naomi. What do they say to her? Now, behind what they say, there is a tremendous concern that we have. We're reading the story, and everything seems fine, except for the major point. The major point to everything that's going on is to redeem Elimelech's name by having a descendant of his be born onto his property. Well, that's all fine and good, except for the fact that Ruth and Boaz, neither one of them are bloodline from Elimelech. Boaz is a blood relative, not bloodline, and Ruth is not related to him in any way. How does this child become a child of Elimelech? Now watch. Tamar Nashim al Naomi. Say, Baruch Adonai asher lo hishpit lach goel hayom. This is the other mention of goel. Blessed is God who has not kept a goel from you. In other words, now you have a redeemer. Who's the redeemer? This little child. We'll see why. V'yikare shmo b'Yisrael. V'yikare shmo b'Yisrael, in common usage today, is a preface to hearing the name of some of a child who's given the name of a brit, usually. That's not what it means here. V'yikare shmo b'Yisrael means he should be famous. They're now blessing Naomi, and they're blessing this child, and the child should be famous, which echoes the blessing given at the court scene 9 months earlier, or however long earlier it was, when they said, Ukrash Shem Bevet Lachem. Now, Vatikach Naomi et hayeled, Vayikareish Mo B'Yisrael, V'hayalach l'meshiv nefesh u'lechalkel et sevatech. This child will be someone who restores your soul and will take care of you in your old age, seva. But seva is old age of grace, old age of a proper old age. Avraham dies b'seva tova. Gideon in Shoftim chapter 8 dies b'seva. A nice old age. So he will take care of you in your old age. Why? Now let's figure out the connection. Ki chalatech asher ahivatech yeladatu. Your daughter-in-law who loved you birthed him. We're still not have to connect the dots. Asher hi tova lach mishiva banim. She is greater to you than seven sons. What are these women saying? What are they accomplishing? What they're essentially doing is saying, root, who loved you and was a greater child to you than seven biological sons could be, was more loyal and more dedicated and more selfless in a relationship to you than all the children in the world could be, she gave birth to him, which means that this kid is your grandson. How is this kid your grandson? Because we are creating a fictive relationship between you and Ruth, not just as daughter-in-law and mother-in-law, but as daughter and mother. And therefore, her child is your grandson. And now everything's changed, because now this child is Naomi's grandson. If it's Naomi's grandson, it's also Elimelech's grandson. And now Elimelech's grandson is growing up on his own property, which has stayed in the family due to the combination of Ruth's initiative and Boaz's response. And as a result of that, a full redemption has taken place of the name of Elimelech. And now what happens? Vatikach Naomi et hayeled, vatishitehu v'cheka. Naomi took the child and she put him in her bosom. She held on to him. Vatilo amenet. She became his nanny, and she took him like a grandmother would take him. Vatikrena lo hashchenot shem lemor. And the neighbors, this is again these women, called the child a name. What name did they give him? Yulad bein la Naomi. Naomi's kid. Naomi's had a child. They called him that. Yulad bein la Naomi. Now, of course, that's not a real name. And they don't have the right to give him a name. The parents do. Vatikrana shmo Oved. But what did they declare? They declared his name was Oved. They were probably tipped off by the family. We're calling him Oved. And now the text ends. Hu avi Yishai avi David. Who is this Oved? He's the father of Yishai. Who's the father of David? Which, by the way, is a dead giveaway that the text was finally completed, as I mentioned in the last podcast, about verse 7, as an interjection that tells us about the shoe symbolism, that this text was finally edited generations later after David is a famous person, and therefore The end of the story is to give us the yichus of Ruth being the father of Oved, the mother of Oved, who's the father of Ishai, who's the father of David. And by the way, when you say Avid David, you don't have to say anything more. You don't have to say David, who is the this. No, because everybody knows who David is. So that means that this is being published at a time when David's name is a famous name. Everybody knows who David is. And this baby is his grandfather. All right. Now, over the course of this second half of the chapter, in the first half of the chapter, as I pointed out in the last podcast, the word Goel in its very various forms came up 14 times. And that was what we call the Leitwort, the key word, because the whole first half of this chapter was about redemption, redeeming the name, redeeming the field, redeeming the woman, all sorts of forms of geula. It's an interaction between Boaz and the Goel. And now, by the way, we understand something about the Goel, the anonymous Goel, remaining anonymous as Ploni Almoni, in light of what we now see in this second half of the chapter. Go back to the beginning of where we picked up today. In the middle of verse 11, the people around, after declaring the formal legal edim, then give this beautiful blessing that the woman should be like Rachel and Leah, and then they say, Ukrash Shem Beit Lachem, be famous in Beit Lachem. Okay? And then, in verse 14, they say again, Vikare Shmo be Israel. He should be famous in Israel. And then again in verse 17, we have the word Shem show up two more times. First of all, his name is Yodlad Ben Lenomi, and then his proper name is Oved. So there's four instances of the word Shem in that section. If we look earlier in chapter 4, and I glossed over it last time because I wanted to hit it now, you take a look at verse 5, that when Boaz throws the monkey wrench into the works and says that on the day that you buy the field from Naomi, you also have to take root, lahakim shem hamet al nachlato. For what purpose? To keep the name of the dead alive on his property. When the Goel refuses to and Boaz takes the deal, Boaz repeats this in verse 9. Verse 10, he says, "V'gan ruta moviyah shemachlon kaniti liyisha l'hakim shem hamet al nachlato." To keep, that's exactly the same phrase. To keep the name of the dead one alive on his property, and then he adds another component. "V'lo yikarei shem hamet, lo yikarei shem hamet mimachav." That the name of the dead should not be cut off from his family and from his place, etc. So now we have seven mentions of the word shem in this chapter. And they are as follows. The first two are exactly the same. L'hakim shem hamet al nachlato, to keep the name of the dead man alive on his property. The third one is the negative side of that, to prevent the cutting off of his name, the disappearance of his name from his family. And then we have the two blessings. He should be famous in Beit Lechem, he should be famous in Israel. And then the two names, Yulad Ben Lenaomi and Oved. Beautiful. Very nice. Then we start looking back and we realize that the word shame also shows up seven times at the beginning of the Megillah. If you go back to chapter 1, you could see that chapter 1 begins quite clearly with a description in verse 2, Shem Ha'ish Alimelech, Shem Ishto Naomi, Shem Ishto Evanam Machlon V'chilion. So in the second verse, you already have three mentions of the word shame, which are Alimelech, his wife, and his two sons together. And then, in verse 4, you have another two mentions, Shem Achat Orpa, Shem Hashanit Rut. So we have the six dramatis personae I introduced in five groups. Him, her, the two sons together, and each of the daughters-in-law separately. So that's five. Then you go to chapter 2, and you find that in the first verse, we find out the name of this relative whose name is Boaz. And at the end of the chapter, in verse 19, Ruth reports that his name is Boaz. Alright, so we've got seven mentions of the word shame in the first two chapters. And we have another seven mentions of the word shame in the last chapter. Alright, maybe we're onto something here. Maybe the word shame really is a key word. Maybe it's a significant word playing out here. But why would such a relatively small word like name be so significant here? Then we take a look and take a look at the printout. And you'll see that the last two mentions of the word shame in the second chapter are both Boaz. The text introduces him and Ruth introduces him. His name is Boaz. Those are the last two. They're at the bottom of the right-hand column of the printout. On the top of the left-hand column, the first two mentions are also exactly the same in chapter 4. V'lo yikare v'lakim she'metal nachlatok, to keep the name of the dead man alive on his property. Now, whose job was it to do that? The answer is quite simple. It was Boaz. Boaz is the one who acted in order to make sure that the name of the dead man would be alive on his property. So he manipulated things in order to keep Elimelech's name alive on his property by linking the marriage of Ruth in with the redemption of the property. Okay, very good. How about the third mention? The third mention of shame in chapter 4 is immediately after the second one, which is the negative. His name should not be cut off. Who was it who has been working throughout the entire story to make sure that his name is not cut off, that Elimelech's name remains? None other but Ruth. Ruth stays with Naomi. Ruth turns the meeting with Boaz from a romantic interlude into an act of geula in order to keep Elimelech's name alive. So it's Ruth who is concerned with making sure his name is not cut off. Look at the third instance the final instance in chapter 1, and on the right-hand column it's number 5, and you'll see that that's Ruth. Very good. Now, back in chapter 4, if you take a look on the left-hand column, the fourth mention of the word shame is to be famous in Beit Lechem. It's part of that blessing. Among all the characters in our story, who was the only one who never got to Beit Lechem? Elimelech was from there. Naomi was from there. Machlon Kilion grew up there. Ruth came back there. Boaz always lived there. Ploni Almoni lived there. The only one in the entire story who never got to Beit Lechem was Orpah. Orpah is the fourth mention of the word shame in chapter 1. She is also the fourth from the last in chapter 4. In other words, Orpah, if she's right in the middle of the seven on both sides, she matches up with herself. What is the fifth mention of the word shame in chapter 4? The fifth mention is V'yikareshmo b'Yisrael, that his name should be famous in Israel. His name should be famous. He should be a famous person. There are two people in this story who are infamous. We know their names, but their names are bad names, and their names are wiped out. They die, they don't leave any children, and that's Machlon v'Chilion. And by the way, they are grouped together in chapter 1, as I just mentioned. Shame shnei vanav Machlon v'Chilion. His sons are named Machlon v'Chilion. They only get one shame, Machlon v'Chilion. And so they match up again with, he should be famous in Israel, is as it were a repair, a tikkun to Machlon v'Chilion. What's the sixth mention in the left-hand column of the word shame? It is when they called the child Yulad Ben LeNaomi. Naomi has a child. That's his name. His name is Naomi's kid. You look back in chapter 1, who's the second one matching up with the sixth? Who is the second one, second name to be mentioned? Naomi. But ultimately, the final mention of shame in Megillat Rut is his real name is Oved. And who is Oved there to keep alive? Who is the first name mentioned in chapter 1? Elimelech. Oved is there to redeem Elimelech. The presence of Oved, especially on his ancestor's property, his fictive ancestor's property, is a redemption for the name of Elimelech and for Elimelech's life. And therefore, as you could see on the chart, the first mention of shame in chapter 1 matches up perfectly with the last one in chapter 4. The next one, number 2, which is Naomi, matches up with the second to last one, Yulad Ben LeNaomi. The third one, which is Machlon v'Chilion, matches up perfectly with V'yikareh Shmo b'Yisrael. They were infamous, they were wiped out, this one should be famous. The fourth one, which is Orpah, matches beautifully with Beit Lechem, she's the only one who didn't get there. It's repaired in Beit Lechem. The fifth one, which is Rut, matches perfectly with the third one, meaning the fifth from the bottom, on the left-hand side, which is to make sure that the name of the dead man is not cut off from his family. That's what was Ruth's motivation. And the last two, in the beginning of the Megillah, in chapter 2, Boaz, who shows up twice, is perfectly matched with the paired mention of to keep alive the name of the dead man on his property, a declaration made twice by Boaz, and Boaz's whole motivation in the way that he manipulated the situation. This also explains something else. We now understand that the entire theme of this book is Geulat Hashem, saving the name, redeeming the memory of someone by keeping them alive. And now we can understand why Chaim Yankel, or whatever the name of the anonymous relative was, got wiped out, and he gets called permanently, and in the best-selling book in history, gets called Mr. Anonymous, Ploni Almoni. He refused to act to keep alive the name of his relative, therefore his name is wiped out. And it's not wiped out in a subtle way where the text would just ignore it. It calls him Ploni-Almoni as if to say, this is the guy who lost his name. He lost his name because he refused to resuscitate and revive the name of Elimelech. Take a look at the chart, you'll see it all play out. In the meantime, the end of the Megillah has an epilogue. After the story's over, we have Ve'ela Toldot Peretz. These are the generations of Peretz. We don't start with Yehuda, we start with Peretz, because this is the Peretz family. Peretz holidit Chetzron. Chetzron holidit Ram. Ram holidit Aminadav. Aminadav holidit Nachshon. Nachshon holidit Salma, which is the same as Salmon. Salmon holidit Boaz. Boaz holidit Oved. Oved holidit Yishai. Yishai holidit David. Now, there are several concerns in this. Why do we start with Peretz? So I already mentioned, this is the family of Peretz. But why don't we end with Boaz or Oved? Why do we go all the way to David? But the bigger question is, look at these generations. Peretz, Chetzron, Ram, Aminadav, Nachshon. That's fine. And that takes us from the descent of Yosef's brothers to Egypt, where Chetzron was already alive, all the way until the Exodus, where Nachshon is already an older man and is the head of the tribe of Judah when they leave. But here's where the problem set in. Nachshon holidit Salma, who is Salmon, and Salmon holidit Boaz. In other words, Boaz's grandfather, according to this, was an older man at the Exodus, which means that, and Nachshon died before he came into the land, nobody made it into the land, that means that Nachshon had to already give birth to Boaz's father when they entered the land, and now Boaz is the great-grandfather of David. There's a huge gap in there. There are just way too many years to make up between the Exodus and David, which is about 350 years or 400 years. What do we do with that? So it's quite clear that in this genealogy, several generations have been skipped. They've been skipped because the author wanted to do something extremely clever, which is to create a genealogy of 10 generations from beginning to end. Count them. Peretz, Chetzron, Ram, Aminadav, that's 4. Nachshon, Salma, that's 6. Boaz, Oved, that's 8. Yishai, David, that's 10. And that is another allusion and association back with the book of Bereishit, where we have explicitly 10 generations to go from Adam to Noach, another 10 generations from Noach to Avraham, that clearly lay out the idea of a new beginning. And now we are about to enter the epoch of royalty, of monarchy, and the 10 generations signify a move from one epoch to another, a new, fresh beginning, the beginning that happens with David. Again, if we look back at the very beginning of this Megillah, it starts with Meshvot HaShoftim, a time of diffusion, a time of tribalism, and ultimately ends with David, which is a time of unity and the united monarchy. Tov, we have hopefully all enjoyed studying Megillat Rut together. It's been my pleasure and honor to teach Megillat Rut over these 10 podcasts. And Mirtz Hashem, after Shavuot, we will continue with a different theme that we will study together. Everyone should have a wonderful Chag HaShavuot, Chag Matan Toratenu, and hopefully everyone will enjoy and appreciate far more the reading of Megillat Rut this year.